Okay, this is the last part of class on January 12th, and we've just gone over some of the important rules of statutory interpretation, the intent of the legislature, the reasonable person test, the plain meaning rule. Now we're doing the golden rule. It's assumed that no legislature intends to be absurd or inconsistent. So the legislation will be interpreted in such a way that it's not absurd and it's not inconsistent. That may mean that they have to change the meaning of some of the wording to make sure it's not absurd or inconsistent. Absurdity or inconsistency is a mistake by the framers of the legislation. If there's a spelling or a grammatical error in legislation, the judges will correct it. We'll read that as if there is no spelling or grammatical error. Wasn't intended to be that way. What was the mischief? You'll often see the judges asking in their decisions, what was the mischief? It's assumed that, now mischief means problem. Every piece of legislation is there to attack a problem of some kind. So what is the problem that the legislature is attacking? That's what the mischief is. And then what is the remedy that the legislature has devised to tackle that particular issue? So that helps to understand the context of the legislation and how it should be applied. Specific words help explain the general ones nearby. Now we have some general words in the Constitution like trade and commerce, and property and civil rights. They overlap quite a bit, right? But which set of words is more specific? You'll see in the readings for next month that property and civil rights is considered to be more specific. Okay, so that helps to inform what trade and commerce means. Trade and commerce does not include property and civil rights. So the specific takes precedence over the general. Express inclusion of some items implies exclusion of items not mentioned. So, the Constitution gives one or the other order of government specific control over something. Okay, let's say direct taxation. If the provinces have control over direct taxation, that means they do not have control over indirect taxation. That's excluded. Aids to interpretation. Interpretation statutes. Ontario and most other provinces in the federal government have statutes that they have passed about this is how the statute is to be interpreted. Interpretation statutes. And those are for the benefit of judges, but also for the benefit of public servants, to help all of you interpret the meaning of the statutes correctly. The definition sections of the statutes. At the very beginning of most pieces of legislation, there's a set of definitions. And that's what you need to look at first in order to figure out what those terms mean later on in the legislation. So those are very, very important. The context of words in the statute is important. Where does it appear in the statute? Does it deal with other similar subject matters? Sometimes they look at other similar statutes. There are similar sections, for example, of the Criminal Code. One section might help the judges to understand another section more clearly. Legislative history, I've already mentioned that they give legislative history minimal weight. Books or rules of interpretation, such as Peter Hogg's constitutional law of Canada is often very helpful to the judges. Legal dictionaries, you'll see them sometimes quote Black's legal dictionary with regard to some difficult words. Now, in Canada, we're lucky because federally we have all of our laws are in French and English, and the same in Quebec and Manitoba and New Brunswick. That's it. And I think in Ontario, many of the statutes have also been translated into French. No legal requirement, but it's considered to be the right thing to do. So that's often very helpful because, as you all know, if you speak some French as well as English, the two different languages can have different nuances. So if you can't understand exactly what is meant in English, sometimes the French version is much more specific. So that's helpful. International conventions and treaties. sometimes international conventions are the impetus for domestic law. So if the domestic law is unclear, you can go back to the international treaty, and it might be more clear than the domestic law, but the law is what they try to implement the treaty, so the treaty is a guide to interpretation. Sometimes there's a preamble, whereas such and such. That indicates what the mischief is sometimes and what the intended remedy is. So sometimes the preamble helps. But there are marginal notes to help you find your way through a long piece of legislation quickly. They are not used as aids to interpretation. They're just aids to finding your way through it quickly. Headings. Legislation often has headings or subheadings, so that it's easy to find one part. But the interpretive statute in Ontario says that judges and others are not to consider the headings in terms of interpreting the legislation. In most provinces, they do. They do use the headings. Any questions so far? Over the years in the common law, a number of presumptions developed. And that's because the government is powerful. The prosecution is powerful. But if you are an accused person, you have to represent yourself, you have to hire a lawyer, you're the weak guy. So the judges have tried to create more of an equal playing field with some of these presumptions. In criminal law, if the law is unclear, there's a presumption in favor of the accused. Taxation law in favor of the taxpayer. Now, I remember a couple of times in my life, I got assessed on my income tax, reassessed, and told I had to pay more taxes. And if you have any questions, you would call a certain number. The first time, I actually went down to Revenue Canada downtown with the Income Tax Act. And they said, well, this is our interpretation of this particular section. And I said, well, here's my interpretation. Did you realize there's a presumption in favor of the taxpayer? It worked. Second time was about 10 years ago. This was all done over the phone. And once again, I said, well, here's my interpretation of the legislation and why I should get this exemption. And they said, well, we've interpreted it differently. And I said, well, there's a presumption in favor of the taxpayer. I would be willing to go to court over this because I think that a judge would decide in my favor. Eventually, I won. I didn't have to go to court. I said, talk to your supervisor. Do they want to go to court? It wasn't for very much money, I must say. But, you know, I enjoy these kinds of arguments when I think I'm right. And also, you know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, when you've got a small family, you know, expenses are quite a bit, and I don't like going into debt. So, mens rea. It's assumed that you can't be convicted of a criminal case unless you were aware of having committed the offense. That's the guilty mind. You have to be aware that you did it. You don't have to be aware of the law. You're presumed to be aware of the law. And if you're not, that's too bad. But you certainly have to be aware of what you've done. So some people, for example, if they're mentally ill, they cannot be convicted for an offense because they didn't know what they were doing. What about if you're drunk? It's presumed that you realize that getting drunk will impair your judgment, and so you're usually found guilty anyway. There have been a couple of minor exceptions in Canadian criminal law, but that's the principle of mens rea. Now, there are exceptions. One of the exceptions to mens rea is absolute liability. That means even if you didn't know what you were doing, you're guilty. And that case came up in the BC Motor Vehicles case, which is mentioned in some of the cases that we're looking at. I'll just mention that for every government, preventing drinking and driving is really, really important. So most provinces have taken the position that if you're convicted of certain offenses, you lose points. And at some point, your license is suspended. And you lose a lot of points for drinking and driving. So in British Columbia, they made it an absolute liability offense that once you get to 15 points, your license is suspended immediately. You're sent a registered letter to tell you your license is suspended. But they figure you ought to know. You should be keeping track of your points and stop driving at that point. Now, some people, they know that their license has been suspended, but they refuse to pick up the registered letter at the post office, right? Mens rea. I didn't realize my license was suspended. So to prevent that from happening, and it had been happening a lot in BC, driving when your license is suspended is an absolute liability offense. In the BC Motor Vehicles case, the Supreme Court of Canada decided that in cases where you could be incarcerated, they can't make that into an absolute liability offense. You have to, if there's a danger of being incarcerated, you have to actually know that your license was suspended, and the government has to make sure that you know. there's a presumption against retroactivity. Once a law is passed, it comes into effect that day. It's not retroactive. Now, some laws are retroactive, but it's built into the law that it is retroactive. but if it's not built into the law, it's assumed it's not retroactive. Against ousting jurisdiction of the courts. This is with regard to privative clauses. A privative clause that says this: the courts have no jurisdiction over this particular area, or there can be no appeal to the courts. Unless it's very, very clear, there's a presumption that the government never wants to oust the jurisdiction of the courts. For Crown immunity. Now, it used to be that you could not sue the Crown, federal or provincial, without the permission of the Crown. the permission was very rarely given. So the presumption was in favor of Crown immunity. But various statutes have overturned that, so that nowadays it's almost as easy to sue the Crown as to sue a corporation or a human being. It's assumed that every word in a statute is there for a reason. Every word is deliberate. I've mentioned this already, specific giving precedence over general. More recent legislation has given precedence over older legislation, if the two seem to conflict. I mentioned this already. Legislatures did not intend any drafting errors, and those will be corrected by judges. Any questions about these various canons of construction and rules of procedure followed by the judges? Yes?
If you can prove that the government or whoever did not inform you of, like, in the license situation, if you can somehow prove that you never received that letter,
well,
or that they never sent it.
Or that they never sent it.
They never sent it, not that you never
then
received
you,
it, that they never sent it.
You can't be convicted for not knowing.
Okay. asking for, no, no, but I'm asking for personal...
You can't be convicted if they can show you were devious. That you intended not to know.
Yes, no, no. But if they actually didn't send it to you, and then you...
If it's an innocent mistake.
Yeah.
Now, the origin of the ideas, the idea of rights in liberal democracies. So John Stuart, well, just from the time of John Locke, after the Glorious Revolution in 1688, it was considered individual freedom is extremely important. And our freedom should only be limited for the greater good of society or to prevent harm. Now, John Stuart Mill, who wrote in the 1800s not only about taxation, but about the meaning of liberty, said that freedom should only be limited to prevent harm to others. So that's the harm principle. And that comes up in some of the decisions that you'll be reading about, especially when the criminal code is involved. So he argued that government should only restrict the freedom of others when it's clearly shown that if they didn't do that, other people are likely to be harmed. What about in the case of individuals harming themselves? Mill argued that governments should not legislate to prevent individuals from harming themselves. That's an individual decision. That's part of our freedom. But all of us have a moral duty to help prevent other people from harming themselves. If you see someone who's becoming an alcoholic and you do nothing, then that's your problem. You have a duty to do something, to intervene. You can't just let it happen. Procedural fairness when there are limits. If our freedom is limited, it can only be limited through due process. So Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. We have a right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Unless the government limits our rights according to the principles of fundamental justice. So there has to be a procedure. Fundamental justice means a lot like natural justice, but it also means due process. There has to be due process. Due process depends on the situation and history and tradition. Equality of application of rights and freedoms. As Dicey pointed out, the rule of law means the law applies equally to everyone, unless there are legitimate reasons for it applying differently. Are there legitimate reasons for people under 16 not being able to get driver's licenses? Their brains haven't developed to that point where they could be trustworthy. What about, are there legitimate reasons for preventing people from under 18 from voting?
No.
No.
That's a really important question. Maybe not. And this will be litigated, but not until lawyers find the right case where they think they're likely to win. So, some of the limits to rights. There are some differences in abilities. It's important to promote honesty. Honesty is the most important value that Canadians and most human beings have, in fact, according to research that I've seen. But you can't defame another person. You can't lie about another person. And so that's why there are libel laws. There's a need to preserve public order. That's another reason for limiting freedoms. To deal with emergencies, the emergency measures, what's it called?
War Measures Act?
No, the War Measures Act, now it's the Emergency Measures Act. Sometimes rights need to be limited because there are conflicts between one right and another. Justice Tulloch mentioned that today. Which is more important, the right to fair and complete defense or a right to religious freedom? Well, you try to balance them both, but But the courts have decided the right to a full defense is more important if you can't balance them. And pornography. That's a very interesting issue. In March, we'll be talking about some of the cases dealing with pornography. But the Supreme Court has decided that, in fact, here's another test that the Supreme Court decided in terms of, in order to find out what is pornography. Pornography is something that is demeaning and... What is the other part of the test? They have a four-part test for the definition of pornography. But part of it deals with community standards. What is the community as a whole willing to tolerate from the point of view of the reasonable person? So that's another reason for some restrictions on freedoms. I think if you're really interested in human rights, it's important to look at the entire history of the development of human rights. In the Western world, it really started with the Renaissance of the 15th century. Protestant Reformation talked about the Glorious Revolution in England, where the Parliament gained control over the king, and also judicial independence was recognized. The major theorist of the Glorious Revolution was John Locke. He had been a physician. He was trained as a physician. And he ended up being the physician of some of the leaders of the Glorious Revolution. He was exiled for about 10 years when things got really bad in Holland. And that's when he began to write about the importance of parliamentary democracy. One of the favorite phrases that I like from his second treatise on government is that he defended the rule of law. The only legitimate law is the law enacted by Parliament. And it has to apply equally to everyone. There should be one rule for the rich and the poor, for the favored at court, and the countryman at plow. So back in 1688, Parliament gained control over the monarchy, could limit the powers of the monarchy. Equality was really important, but people didn't think of all the implications of equality. Equality meant all propertied males could vote. They were the equal ones. But when you read Locke, he doesn't talk about propertied males. He talks about equality in general. And so his writings, which are actually very inspiring the way they were written, partly led to the American Revolution and have informed people who believe in human rights ever since that time. He believed in equality for everybody because he believed that everyone is equal in the sight of God. Everyone. So everyone deserves to be treated as an equal. And in his writings, not in the Second Treatise, but in others of his writings, he said that this is a principle in every major religion. We're all equal in the sight of God. And everybody deserves religious tolerance. There was one exception for him. He couldn't stand atheists. He didn't know where they got their values from. Yes?
But wasn't there a constitution with the American... a conflict or contradiction with the American Constitution because of slavery, because of their legislation?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's like his argument... Like, that's why they did believe only white males who owned property were equal, mm-hmm. because everybody else was considered human in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because they owned them. Mm-hmm. So
that
they
type
had to
of thinking.
Use that theory to run with some of the ideology that
Yeah. Locke didn't agree with slavery. And so that type of writing eventually led to the abolition of slavery in stages in Britain. Took longer in the United States. So that's why equality, it's a really important concept. And everybody agrees with it. But then you begin to think of its implications and it becomes much more complex. Are we really an equal? But one thing that really disturbs me is that there's an increasing gap between the rich and the poor in Canada. That's wrong. And when you actually, there was a study done by Peter Russell and others about 15 years ago. about the attitudes of Canadians towards equality issues. Wonderful, wonderful survey done. Most Canadians are willing to accept some differences in income, because some people work harder, they had to get an education, they deserve to be compensated for being so dedicated. But they don't tolerate large gaps in income. And that's where we're at today, and it's going to lead to all kinds of problems. So, over the years after 1700, the way the common law developed was to gradually provide more and more protections for individual freedom. There was a case in 1765 where one of the cabinet ministers in the UK ordered someone's property to be searched, and there was no search warrant. That person had the audacity to go to court. I think it was Entick, and Carrington was the cabinet minister. And Entick won. And the court said, no, you can't search someone's property without a search warrant. That's an abuse of power. The Crown must prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's why in serious criminal cases, especially in jury trials, the jury is told, you cannot convict if you have any reasonable doubts whatsoever. You have to be certain. Because the consequences for the accused person are really severe. We don't want innocent people going to jail for life, or in the old days being executed. So it's really hard to reach that stage beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's why we were talking about sexual assault cases earlier. Aggravated sexual assault, which is the highest level, it's often very difficult to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. Sometimes it's wise for the prosecutors to, I think there are two lower tiers of sexual assault that they can charge someone with. It's much easier to get a conviction. And often they will go with the lower levels for that reason. People have to make free confessions. They can't be forced to confess. And people cannot be forced to self-incriminate. So someone, through being a witness in the trial, says something that incriminates them about a different crime, that evidence can't be used against them. So these are all common law protections that grew up over the years. Yes?
Do we have something very similar to Americans, like
you can plead the fifth,
incriminating yourself.
You can't. We don't say it that way, but yes, you cannot be. You can't be forced to give evidence against your will. That includes. There's some exceptions to that, but you can't be forced to give a breathalyzer test against your will. But if you don't, the penalty is the same. So, my view of democracy is it's a work in progress. I mean, we've been working on democracy probably for 40,000 years as human beings. And in certain periods of time, I think it began to flourish in England more than other parts of the world because it was isolated. They were kind of protected from some of the wars on the continent, so they had time for these experiments to advance further. But after 1688, when Parliament got control over the monarchy, the next step was extension of the franchise to make sure that more people could vote. But it wasn't until 1960 that we had a universal franchise in Canada where all women could vote and all Aboriginal peoples could vote. It takes time. The next step, I think, was attack on corruption. Up until the late 1800s, early 1900s, all governments in Canada, the US, the UK, the public service was composed of political appointees. There was a movement against that. It was very inefficient, and then our standards of living were lower. So there was a movement against corruption and patronage. We still have patronage, but it's reserved to the upper levels now. Still shouldn't be there, from my perspective. You know, the Caribbean constitutions are much better than ours in that there are certain mechanisms there to prevent patronage. Doesn't always work, but at least it's in the Constitution. The next step is the promotion of human rights. And that started in Canada in the early 1900s, but it built until the Canadian Bill of Rights in 1960, the Saskatchewan Bill of Rights, which came about in the 1940s. And the next step that we're at right now is the promotion of ethics in government. And Canada is a world leader in terms of ethics regimes for preventing conflict of interest. I'll get into that in another time, maybe in the absinthe. So the U.S. Bill of Rights has had a lot to do with thinking about human rights along the world, around the world. The Bill of Rights was put into place basically because the states didn't trust the central government, and they wanted states' rights to be protected. But for a long time, for example, the guarantee of equality in the U.S. Bill of Rights was interpreted by the courts to mean that it's okay to have separation between blacks and whites, as long as the separation is more or less equal, which meant whites were a lot better off. So that's one of the difficulties with courts interpreting a written Bill of Rights. They can interpret it very conservatively, like the Americans did until the 1960s. And then you're stuck with a Bill of Rights that's supposed to protect rights, and it doesn't. It does just the opposite. But the wording of the American, now much of what's in the American Bill of Rights comes from the common law rights that had been developed in England up until that time. And there were some new rights added, like the right to bear arms. Because just in case the British invaded again, everybody should be armed to fend them off. So they've got to work in bringing their constitution up to date. It's causing problems for everybody else. But the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is a model now around the world for other countries that are considering bills of rights. The American Bill of Rights is outdated. Yes?
I'm just curious about the last point, the refusal of accommodation to soldiers. How it came about, like, what's its context?
Well, during the American War of Independence, the British soldiers considered that they could stay anywhere. They could move into someone's house, use all the supplies, wreck it if they wanted, and then leave it. That was their right. And a lot of Americans got very upset about this. So into their constitution they put, you have a right not to give accommodation to soldiers. My house is my castle. Yes?
Didn't the Americans do the same thing when they came up here?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting looking at the War of 1812. We're almost out of time. I mentioned to you already Section 133 of the B&A Act. Just give me another minute or two, please. Which was a little Bill of Rights with regard to language rights. And I haven't gotten to the two cases I wanted to talk to you about today, the Alberta Press case, which was on the reading list for today. And the other really important one was Lavelle and Bedard in 1974, but you need to understand Drybones before that. So at the beginning of the next class in February, I'll start by discussing these cases. Then we'll go on to those cases for February. Any questions?
Yeah, very quickly, would you be able to add on to what's expected for the presentation?
For the presentations. Some of you came a little late, so 4 minutes. It's really important for all of you to do all the readings in order to do well in your assignments. So assume that your fellow classmates have done the readings or at least skimmed through them. You don't need to summarize it, but what I want you to say are, here are the major points that I got from the readings. Here's what's really important for a class of public servants who are trying to understand Canadian constitutional law. This is what's really important. And then you can say, here are one or two questions that I think the class should discuss. Now, I will be, if you don't show up for your presentation, I will give it for you. So I'm prepared for all the presentations. So if there's some points that I would like discussed and you don't bring up, I will bring them up. But try to keep your comments to just 4 minutes. And some students just present like this without any PowerPoint. Others have PowerPoint or some other form of media communication. You can do anything that you like. But it's just, it gets awfully boring if I do all the talking. So if we have one of you lead the discussion about each of the required readings, it makes a lot more sense. Does that help?
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions? What? Oh, of course. Yes. So in the last class, you were connected to Moodle with Professor Sonica. If I can get your attention. I now have access to the Section A Moodle site. So that's where I'll be posting the videos, the audio streams of the classes, and other important class information. But in the meantime, as I transition to Moodle, I'll still be using my own web page. Okay? Any other questions? Anyway, in a few minutes, if any of you have time, I'm going to go down to the absinthe for a while and relax. So. You're welcome to join me. Professor Fredrickson is doing the same.
And I'm sorry.